It's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And Uncle Dennis suggests that you have a pencil and paper ready because there just might be something you want to write down, some web page, some date and time that might be important to you. So tomorrow is the 23rd Memorial Gathering of Judy Berry Day. By that we mean the day in which someone, perhaps hired by the FBI, blew up the car that Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney were riding in Oakland, California. And there will be a gathering at the scene, and the scene is Oakland High School at the corner of Park Boulevard and East 33rd near MacArthur in Oakland. They're asking folks to gather at 11:30, and right around noon they will mark the moment of the bombing. Please bring songbooks if you have them, because there will be music going on and you'll probably want to sing along. Who bombed Judy Berry? And the FBI Give Back My Violin and various songs like that. Perhaps Daryl Cherney will be there to relive that whole event. But if you want more information about it, go to www.judyberry.org. That's JUDIBARI.org. And once again, that gathering tomorrow, Friday, May 23rd at 11:30 at the corner of Park Boulevard and East 33rd near MacArthur in Oakland, California. Moving up north, Earth First Humboldt has dropped an awesome banner by Strawberry Rock on Highway 101, and the Redwood Coast Rendezvous is being planned. Last week, activists in Northern California took to the skies with a protest against excessive local logging. Deployed at about 9 a.m. and riding high at about 100 feet over the road, the banner was hard to miss if you were heading north from Trinidad on Highway 101. Green Diamond Resource Company has been continuing their destructive clear-cutting legacy, highlighted by the banner hang at Strawberry Rock. And come on out to the mountains of Humboldt County for this year's Redwood Coast Rendezvous from June 14th to 18th. This summer looks like a hot one for direct action against extraction across the continent. Consequently, we'll be focusing on skill sharing and training in order to spread the knowledge of practical blockading techniques, technical rope climbing, more direct action techniques, and campaign organizing. In the Redwood region alone, there are two ongoing direct action campaigns. In Willits, the California Highway Patrol and their riot squad can't keep the Little Lake Valley defenders down as tree sits continue to go up in the path of destruction planned for the new Highway 101 bypass around the town and through the ancient trees and wetlands. And in northern Humboldt, tree sitters are holding strong in some of the oldest and largest redwoods in the Trinidad area as Green Diamond's logging echoes down from the hills. And Earth First Humboldt invites you to go to their website to sign up for the location and details on Redwood Coast Rendezvous. Once again, that's June 14th through the 18th. That webpage, www.efhumboldt.org. That's EFHUMBOLDT.org. And volunteers have saved endangered steelhead in the Carmel River this last weekend. Sunday, May 19th, the Carmel River Steelhead Association was authorized by the National Marine Fisheries Service to rescue steelhead stranded in the Carmel River. The Carmel River is drying up quickly this year because of a lack of rain and continuing overpumping of water from wells. Fish, which came up the river in early May to spawn, can't get back to the sea. The Carmel River Steelhead Association patrols the river continually looking for fish in danger. It then alerts the agency responsible for rescues. These fish were found near the Villa Mallorca Bridge and would have soon died if not rescued. But confusing permit processes and incomplete interagency agreements prohibited the Carmel River Steelhead Association from rescuing the fish immediately. The agency, thought to be responsible for rescuing fish in that portion of the river's main stem, did not respond to the emergency. So the National Marine Fisheries Service finally authorized the Carmel River Steelhead Association to perform an emergency rescue. It was a tricky operation because the fish had to be helped to adapt to seawater before going to sea. So the CRSA team brought the fish to Carmel Lagoon and lugged buckets one by one to the tanks containing the rescued fish. The seawater was added to the tank's freshwater bucket by bucket so the fish could transform their respiratory systems to process seawater. Temperatures of the tank were also cooled down by several degrees in the process to acclimate the fish to seawater temperatures, too. Then they were transferred to big coolers and carried one at a time to the sea and released to the vast Pacific Ocean. The steelhead swiftly took to the sea. Their magnificent odyssey, swimming thousands of miles for the next 2 or 3 years, was underway. And they may be back for a new challenge in the Carmel River. Steelhead returned to their natal streams 2 or 3 times in their lifetime to create new progeny, if we can fix the river. The project took hours and saved a genetically distinct May run of steelhead that luckily would have become extinct otherwise. Now, thanks to the all-volunteer Carmel River Steelhead Association, they have a chance. And if you want more information about this or anything else to do with the Carmel River, go to www.CarmelRiverSteelheadAssociation, all one word, .org. That's got to be a mess of typing. CarmelRiverSteelheadAssociation.org. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. After last week's brutal hazing operations, a few hundred wild buffalo migrated back to the habitat they had been evicted from in the Hebgen Basin, west of Yellowstone National Park. Yellowstone is located at a higher elevation, so spring green-up happens earlier. Naturally, buffalo must travel to lower elevations to find the grasses they need. Nevertheless, hazing operations took place every day except Saturday. Sunday and Monday, the Montana Departments of Livestock and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks conducted some hazing, but by Tuesday, all the agencies and law enforcement were back for more large-scale operations. Monday morning brought 4 riders representing the Montana Department of Livestock and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks back to the Denny Creek South Fork area, where wild buffalo love to be. The agencies aggressively hazed 2 bull bison, nearly forcing them to run into barbed wire and high-tension wire fences before picking up family groups with numerous baby buffalo. More than 175 wild buffalo were hazed miles down the Madison Arm Road corridor, thick forest full of deadfall and mucky lakeshore. The haze ended west of Yellowstone National Park, letting us know that the agents would return with reinforcements. Tuesday, the agents did return in full force to haze the buffalo they had just hazed the day before. The Interagency Cooperation in Wild Bison Harassment on our public lands Inspector Bridger Cunningham, joined by USDA APHIS worker Ryan Clark, riding on an ATV to haze a family group of buffalo. The baby in the photo is seen panting through the haze, barely gone a mile. These buffalo would be pushed up to 7 miles on this day through deadfall and swollen rivers. During the haze, we noticed Montana Department of Livestock Inspector Jeff Bowers had a handgun in his hands. And as the last photo shows, we learned that he was shooting the buffalo with red paintballs, an utterly disrespectful action they take to mark certain buffalo. In the last, there was a picture of the stuff on the webpage. As you can see, the last buffalo on the far left has been shot in the eye with red paint. He claimed she was being ornery. He had been harassing her and her family for weeks, had shot her yearling with paintballs earlier, and then shot her in the eye for being upset about it. We were to see numerous buffalo with red paint on them that day. One cannot continuously abuse animals and expect that there will be no consequence. Soon after that incident, one of the Montana Department of Livestock horses began to protest. Montana Department of Livestock Inspector Bridger Cunningham was aggressively trying to force his horse to move buffalo, but the horse wasn't having any of it. Bridger was ejected from the saddle and injured his wrist. His unfortunate horse bolted in fear, running through the thick forest covered with deadfall, and suffered a puncture wound to the chest. Bridger was taken away in an ambulance, and the horse was taken to a vet. As this was happening, hazing halted, we could hear the birds start singing again, and the buffalo got a bit of respite, a little time to graze, nurse, and get in some good wallowing. 5 hours and 5 miles later, the buffalo had been run across U.S. Highway 191 east towards Yellowstone National Park. The agents pushed more than 200 buffalo towards the spring-flooded Madison River and kept riding back and forth behind them, hooting and hollering to make them swim across. The buffalo would have never chosen such spots to cross, especially with their calves. Adult buffalo were having difficult times in the strong currents, and baby buffalo were being swept downstream. The adults worked together to help the exhausted calves to shore and up onto the steep banks. Other buffalo were forced to cross an even stronger river current, and the riders stood around and watched as adult buffalo worked very hard to get across, and even more babies were swept downstream, struggling with all their might to make it to shore. There were moments when we thought we were going to go swimming ourselves, going in after baby buffalo. But the moms came back into the water after them, sheltering their tired little bodies to the shore. They will place themselves upriver to help break the current, or downriver to block them calves from floating away. It is incredible how devoted buffalo moms are and how strong these little buffalo are, being harassed daily and somehow, but not always, still having strength to keep up with the herd. Their will to live is enormous, their courage even stronger, but the haze didn't stop there. The riders, knowing how strong the current was, never crossed it themselves or with their horses. They rode around up the bluffs and came after the buffalo again, pushing them a few more miles into Yellowstone National Park. Wednesday morning, the agents gathered again near the edge of Yellowstone National Park, 16 state and federal workers representing four of the five interagency bison management plan cohorts, riders and overseers, biologists and law enforcement, made their plans to go find the buffalo they had so abusively treated the day before, and indeed for weeks on end now, and pushed them another 7 miles into the park. Actions like these are carried out because Montana livestock interests still attempt to claim that wild bison present a brucellosis threat, or more realistically, a threat to their cowboy culture. Millions of federal tax dollars are wasted each year to appease this lifestyle and abuse wild buffalo on their ground that is their ancestral birthright. We are not powerless. There are three things you can do today to make your voice heard and to help the wild buffalo. Contact the Montana Department of Livestock and tell them to stop this bison abuse. Even if they don't act, they need to know that people oppose their actions. 2. Contact your members of Congress and urge them to support legislation that honors and protects America's last wild buffalo. And 3. Help keep the Buffalo Field Campaign on the front lines. Thank you. Announcing the Buffalo Field Campaign's Free Buffalo Museum. They are going to be making a transition this summer from tabling inside Yellowstone National Park to opening a Free Buffalo Museum just outside the west entrance in the town of West Yellowstone. The museum will take you on an incredible buffalo journey through their storied history and amazing natural lives to their current plight and the efforts of the people standing in their defense. The museum will showcase photos, artwork, images, and video, as well as buffalo items you can touch, plus Buffalo Field Campaign merchandise. Standing guard and welcoming all will be our ever-popular Buffaloon, a giant inflatable buffalo who will lead the way to Buffalo Field Campaign's Free Buffalo Museum. And volunteers are wanted. There are immediate openings for field volunteers to help with our frontline patrols now through June. We are also seeking summer volunteers who can help us conduct outreach and education, represent Buffalo Field Campaign and the Buffalo to Yellowstone visitors at the new Free Buffalo Museum in West Yellowstone. And there is a legal and field internship open for fall and summer. Buffalo Field Campaign and their ally Western Watersheds Project are seeking a legal and field intern who can help with reviewing project files and documenting conditions in the field for several Forest Service grazing allotments in West Yellowstone and Gardner Basins, and creating legal documents. For more information, contact the Buffalo Field Campaign at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. If you have a donation, send it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. Their phone number, 406-646-0070. All this information and more is at their extensive webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife has cited two for abalone poaching in a marine protected area. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife warden cited two Southern California men for illegally taking abalone from the marine protected area near Laguna Beach recently. CDFW wildlife officers observed Junie Pong, 47, from El Monte, and Kwang Yi, 47, from Yorba Linda, entering the ocean at Moss Cove and Laguna Beach in full scuba gear. After more than an hour of diving, the two men returned to the beach and were met by an officer who found two green abalone in each of the men's diving gear. Both suspects were cited for possession of abalone and the take of fish inside a marine protected area, both potential misdemeanor violations, and then released. The abalone were photographed for evidence and returned to the sea. The men's diving equipment was confiscated and impounded as evidence. Abalone may only be taken north of San Francisco Bay during prescribed seasons. For abalone fishing regulations and the location of marine protected areas, go to www.dfg.ca.gov. That's dfg.ca.gov. This case has been forwarded to the Orange County District Attorney's Office for prosecution. And more North Coast land has fallen under protection in this story by Jason Hoppen of the Scotts Valley Sea Isle. The Sempervirens Fund on Wednesday announced a joint preservation effort with a handful of Bonny Doon homeowners that preserves 151 North Coast acres from logging. The $500,000 deal impacts a patch of land wedged between the Cemex Redwoods and the Coast Dairy properties, two properties recently targeted for conservation that together comprise 15,000 acres. It is the first rights-only purchase for the century-old Sempervirens Fund and includes the Mill Creek headwaters. There is always a first for everything as we pioneer new land protection techniques tailor-made to each situation, Sempervirens Director Reed Holderman said. We are proud to join with the Redwood Meadows Ranch Homeowners Association to find a local solution to a local issue that potentially had larger implications for the large entire Mill Creek watershed. There are a dozen landowners in the area who kicked in half the money for the purchase. Though the property had not been logged in decades, original developer Bill Cunningham recently filed a timber harvest plan which included some of the 4,000 redwoods located there. There were definitely a lot of strong feelings and competing interests involved in this transaction, Cunningham said, but Sempervirens Fund turned it into a win-win situation. Sempervirens won't harvest trees from the property, Holderman said, but the deal does not include public access rights. Instead, Sempervirens bought the timber rights without buying the underlying land. Redwood Meadows Ranch Homeowners Association President Pamela Koch said the surrounding preservation efforts at Cemex and Coast Dairies impacted how the landowners view the property. I personally felt this strong sense of the environmental significance of this land, Koch said, saying protecting the natural and water resources was important to residents. Mill Creek is a backup water source for the city of Davenport. Sempervirens Fund and the Peninsula Open Space Trust acquired the 8,500-acre Cemex Redwood property in last year for $30 million and have planned a rotating timber harvest on one-third of the property. A public access plan for the rest of the property is still a year away. The 7,000-acre Coast Dairies property was secured by the Trust for Public Land in 1998, with most of it to be managed by the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. And there's no trace left of three types of butterflies native to South Florida. The story reported by Barbara Liston with editing by Tom Brown and Phil Berlewitz of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. After 6 years of searching, an entomologist has concluded that three varieties of butterflies native to South Florida have become extinct, nearly doubling the number of North American butterflies known to be gone. These are unique butterflies to Florida. This is our biological treasure. Each unique species that we lose, we won't ever get that back again, said Mark Minow, who conducted the survey for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District. The disappearance of butterflies should serve as a warning about degradation of South Florida's environment, he said. It's indicating there were major problems, environmental harm to Florida. And this is an indication that quality for people is also degrading, and people should be worried about that, Minow said. Before Minow's survey, only four varieties of North American butterflies, all from California, were presumed to be extinct, and the last one added to the list was 55 years ago. Besides the three varieties which Minow concluded are extinct, two more native butterflies no longer exist in Florida, but are living elsewhere in the Caribbean, and two more are headed for extinction. What is happening to the Florida butterflies remains an unanswered question. The Shouse swallowtail, found only in the upper Florida Keys, became in 1976 one of the first insects ever given legal protection under the Federal Endangered Species Act. Minow said only six of the swallowtails were sighted in 2012. Scientists began noticing a general decline in the butterfly populations in the 1980s, and Minow, like many scientists, assumed the spraying of pesticides to kill mosquitoes might be at fault. But his survey suggested otherwise. In urban areas such as Key West, which has little natural habitat remaining and is routinely sprayed, Minow said, there are so many butterflies flying you can hardly keep track of them all. There are just swarms of butterflies sometimes. You just wonder what the heck is going on. It's just the opposite of what you might think. In contrast, Minow said he found few butterflies in vast conservation lands without mosquito control, such as the million-acre Everglades National Park and Biscayne National Park. One of his theories is that mosquito spraying might bolster butterfly populations by killing off native and non-native parasitic wasps that feed on the butterfly larvae and their caterpillars. Another theory is that invasive predatory ants, such as the Mexican twig ant and fire ants, which were introduced to the area in the 1970s and are unrestrained by pesticides in conservation areas, might be overwhelming butterfly populations there. Minow said the three butterflies were found only in southern Florida and are now extinct are the Florida Zesto skipper, the Rockland Meskies skipper, and the Keys Zeruco skipper. In addition, the Bahamian swallowtails and the Knickerbean blues are gone from Florida, but are still alive elsewhere in the Caribbean. Minow also expressed the Shouse swallowtail and the Miami blue, both of which continue to decline despite formal recovery plans, to become extinct soon. Of 120 varieties of butterflies documented in the Florida Keys, Minow said 18 have become imperiled since the 1970s. Minow said no state, federal, or private agency has funded research to find out what is causing the decline. And the Klamath water wars have turned to tribal rights in this story by FishLink. The Upper Klamath Basin in Oregon has traditionally been the site of federally irrigated farms, depressed fish populations, and hydroelectric dams that obstruct one of the largest salmon runs on the West Coast. The over-appropriated Klamath Basin has also been the site of some of the nation's most bitter water allocation disputes. The Klamath Settlement Agreement, signed in February of 2010, were a 43-party stakeholder settlement agreement intended to put an end to nearly 100 years of these bitter water conflicts and restore valuable salmon fisheries, but it is still languishing in Congress and cannot yet be implemented. Now a new water war is on the verge of breaking out in the Klamath Basin. After more than 38 years of judicial proceedings, the Klamath water adjudication process has now resulted in an adjudication order that gives the Klamath tribes the most senior water rights in the basin, dating from time immemorial, and awarded the tribes a great deal of its limited water. Oregon's water right laws now give the Klamath tribes the right under its first-in-time, first-in-right doctrine to cut off any or all junior water rights holders if water levels in the Upper Klamath Lake and the Klamath River drop too low to sustain fish and wildlife resources guaranteed to the tribes under federal treaties. To complicate matters, the Upper Klamath Basin is now suffering from a serious drought, and a declaration of drought emergency was issued by Oregon's Governor Kitzhaber in an executive order on April 18th. Upper Klamath Basin farmers could see their water shut off this summer if water levels drop too low, letting their crops spoil, while tribes fear retaliation if they choose to turn off water in the area. But without congressional approval of the languishing Klamath settlement agreements, which contains a much better water-sharing settlement agreement as well as its own drought plan, the tribes may have no choice except to exercise their senior water rights in order to protect their treaty-protected resources. Tribal Council member Jeff Mitchell, the lead negotiator on water issues, explains the tribe's reasoning further, remarking, "A lot of people's water could be shut off, and that has huge implications, and it affects people's livelihoods to the core. But I also look at our fishery that is on the brink of extinction. We have a responsibility to protect that resource, and we'll do what we need to do to make sure that the fish survive." If you want to learn more about the Klamath Settlement Agreements, go to www.klamathcouncil.org. That's klamathcouncil.org. And the largest dam in California state history is to be torn down. In this story by Dan Ashley of ABC News, Monterey County supervisors have given their okay for the largest dam removal project in California state history. The San Clemente Dam is 18 miles from the coast in the Carmel Valley. The 90-year-old, 106-foot-tall dam was once a major source of water on the Monterey Peninsula, but it has reached the end of its useful life. The dam was deemed to be seismically unsafe in 1995, said California Water, American Water spokesperson Catherine Bowie, and she added that as the water provider, we had to do something to resolve that safety issue. So the company set out a plan to retrofit the dam. But then the natural resource agencies from the state and federal level stepped in and said, we want to do more than solve the safety issue, strengthen the dam with concrete. We want to see if we can really improve the dam, said Bowie. Tearing down a dam isn't as simple as you think. You can't just knock it down and let the water go. That's because sediment from upstream has backed up behind the dam. It would take 250,000 dump trucks to haul away all the silt that has gathered behind this dam. And just letting it flow downstream would harm the endangered steelhead trout that use the river to breed. The species is already on the verge of vanishing from the Carmel River. Joyce Ambrosius with the National Marine Fisheries Service said the steelhead numbers have been dwindling over the past couple of years. It's been down to 91 in the last couple of years, where in the 1960s it was in the thousands of fish. So we are right on the edge of them blinking out here, she said. Ambrosius has spent the last 15 years waiting for the dam to come down. She says the dam removal can't come soon enough. Right now, the fish have to come up a very steep fish ladder. Some of the steps are 3 feet tall, and only the strongest fish can make it up just to get past the dam. Tearing down the dam may open a way to species recovery. There is now a plan in place to do just that. Project manager Jeff Sistel explained, we're going to build a diversion dike to permanently reroute the river around the existing sediment pile. He added that they will then restore the site to return health to the river. The cost to upgrade the dam was $49 million. Removing the dam would cost $83 million. The utility balked at the idea of picking up the whole tab, so Representative Sam Farr, a Democrat from Salinas, stepped in to broker a compromise. There is no opposition to this. This is absolutely the right thing to do. You don't have those moments very often in politics, said Mr. Farr. Under the agreement, California American ratepayers will pay $50 million towards the demolition through increases in their water bills. The State Coastal Conservancy and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration are committed to raising an additional $35 million through a combination of public funding and private donations. It's been an amazing project to work on, and it will be the biggest dam removed in California. It's very exciting, said Trish Chapman of the California Coastal Commission, Coastal Conservancy, a state agency. When the project is done, the area will be open again to the public. The federal government will rededicate 928 acres as parkland, and preliminary work on the dam removal will begin this summer. It will take about 3 years to remove the entire structure. And that's all the time we have for news this week on the Earth First Update. Be sure to tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for a live version of the Earth First Update. You can hear a rebroadcast right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon. Or if you're in Moscow, Idaho, you can tune in on Monday evenings at 9:30 on Radio Free Moscow, KRFP 92.5 FM. If you'd like to download a copy or listen online to the Earth First Update, you can go to radioforall.net. That's radioforall.net and search for Earth First Update. Be sure and include the exclamation point. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio. It's produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening and to tune in again next week.